Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest has a new book that tears into the idea that incarceration is an answer to violence. Michelle Alexander, author of the seminal book about mass incarceration, The New Jim Crow, has praised the book and is being called a groundbreaking addition to the incarceration debate. The book is titled Until We Reckon: Violence, Mass Incarceration, and the Road to Repair, and the author, Danielle Sirid, is the executive director of Common Justice, a group that helps connect crime survivors. This is violent crime survivors, and that's where this book is going to be different than a lot of things you've heard before. Connects crime survivors to forms of justice outside the criminal justice system, arguing from the side of victims and the communities most affected by violence. Danielle goes beyond acknowledging that incarceration is a poor deterrence and makes a case for why incarceration actually makes people feel less safe from violence. Danielle, welcome to WNYC this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And sort of, you know, right to the punch here, that so much of the debate about mass incarceration has been stepping back on nonviolent crimes. You want criminal justice reform in the way we look at punishment for violent ones too, right?
That's exactly right. And there are a couple reasons for it. The first is that more than half of people locked up in the United States are locked up for crimes of violence. So we will not see transformative reductions or a way out of being the jailingest nation in all of human history if we don't take on violence. But equally, we know that mass incarceration not only fails to reduce violence, it produces it. And so if we care about reducing violence, if we care about people's safety, we have to develop other ways to address harm.
And so before we get into how this looks from the victim side, you write that going to prison means that the perpetrators of violent crimes don't have to acknowledge or face accountability for their actions. That's probably the opposite of what a lot of people think.
So punishment is passive. Like, punishment is something that someone else does to us, and all we have to do to be punished is not escape it. It doesn't actually provide anything of value to the people who are hurt. Accountability is different. It requires that we acknowledge what we did, that we acknowledge its impact, that we express remorse, that we make things as right as possible in a way defined by those we hurt, and that we do the hard labor of becoming someone who will never cause that harm ever again. Accountability is some of the hardest work we'll ever do, and we believe people who cause harm are both entitled to an opportunity to do it, but also obligated.
And you refer to a period when you taught creative writing to incarcerated men, and almost none of them took responsibility for their crimes.
The criminal justice system is not designed for people to take responsibility. You're encouraged by your one advocate, your defense attorney, to plead not guilty. If you do eventually take a plea, it's usually to a lesser or included charge that doesn't quite match up to what you've done. And within prison, there is virtually no space to allow reflection, let alone something like atonement or repair.
And you argue that survivors of violent crime must be included more in how justice is carried out. And I take it from your previous answer that you want restorative justice, you want face-to-face interaction between perpetrators and their victims?
When that's what the survivors want, yes. So when in Common Justice, where we operate in Brooklyn and the Bronx, we give survivors of violence a choice between whether the person who hurt them will be incarcerated and whether they'll come to Common Justice. And 90% of survivors choose Common Justice. 90%. And it's not for the reasons we think at first, predominantly. It's not mostly because they're merciful or compassionate or believe in change or think, but for the grace of God, go I. It's because they're pragmatic. They live in neighborhoods where incarceration is common, and they see it fail over and over and over again. So when they choose something different, they are choosing something that they believe will keep them safe and will keep others safe in a way they have learned at great cost incarceration can't.
Tell us the story from your book of two young men, Sean and Daquan, and, well, tell us from the beginning what happened and then how Common Justice got involved.
So in this case, A young man shot at a former friend of his in a public park in front of that young man's baby sister. When the survivor of that crime ran for his life, he hid for a while, and then he decided that he would tell the police, knowing that after that he would probably leave the city. When he went to tell the police what happened to him, he said, "I was shot at in this park. My baby sister saw it. I don't know where she is. I know who did it." The first question he was asked was, "Where's your gun?" He said, "What?" The police said, "Well, he didn't shoot you for nothing." So we have to understand that central to the racial inequities in the criminal justice system are inequities in how we treat crime survivors. A young man of color is actually 10 and a half more times more likely than I am as a white woman to be a victim of robbery or assault. And yet still we tell the story as though my experience is representative and as though young men of color are only ever perpetrators of violence. It is hard to imagine how that young man who was met with that response from the police could possibly have anticipated that the criminal justice system would deliver him justice or safety thereafter.
My guest is Daniel Sirid, Executive Director of Common Justice, a group that's Brooklyn-based that helps connect crime survivors to forms of justice outside the usual criminal justice system. Her new book is called Until We Reckon: Violence, Mass Incarceration, and the Road to Repair. We have time for maybe a couple of phone calls for her. Anyone have a story along these lines, a personal experience that you might want to share, or a reaction? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. This is criminal justice reform regarding violent crime when so much of the focus has been on nonviolent crime. Her argument is putting people away in prison in the way that we do actually winds up making community members less safe. And you're right that our understanding of what survivors want is distorted by two extremes. One is revenge, and the other is extreme mercy, in which you cited the Charleston Church massacre, the killer Dylann Roof, of course, and how the press ate up the idea that the families of the victims, and who could forget this, including a local pastor, forgave him right away.
So I think, you know, there are unquestionably crime survivors who are furious and want someone put away forever, executed, buried under the jail. There are crime survivors who are capable of a speed or degree of mercy that many of us may not be. The vast majority of us, I mean, and by that I mean, what, 99%? We're somewhere in between. We feel rage, we feel fear, we feel loss, we feel compassion, we feel a desire for change, we feel a skepticism about change, we feel a tension between our values and our experience, we feel a wide range of things. And the one thing that can help those things cohere for us is that when we are faced with options, we will choose the thing that meets our two most basic needs as survivors. The things we can't tolerate as survivors, we cannot tolerate the idea of going through it again, and we cannot tolerate the idea of someone else going through it. So even as we experience a vast range of feelings, we will choose the option that we think is most likely to produce those outcomes.
Let's take a phone call. Desmond in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Desmond.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call, Brian. I want to thank Ms. Sirid. I haven't even had a chance to, but I did purchase your book because I saw it mentioned in the op-ed that was done by Michelle Alexander. And I've seen outsized problems coming from the disenfranchisement of people, but in a different vector. We did a seminar in our community. It was done for us with the young men whose parents were incarcerated. And it's basically their loss of humanity, because no matter how bad that person was at the moment they committed their crime, that was their attachment to a male figure. And these young men were growing up angry, and you don't understand that until you hear them and get in a seminar in a means where they can talk about it, the void in their lives. And I've also seen it with the young boy, or had it told to me, the young boy who was shot in the pink houses by the police. And the way he changed as a student in his school. Oh, my church sister was his teacher. So all of these things, for men and women, for young boys and girls, the loss of humanity, the loss of attachment that happens through violence is incredible. And I'm so glad that you've brought this story out and working for reconciliation.
Desmond, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you so much, Desmond. And you're exactly right. And part of what is true and what you're talking about is the fact that our safety is actually produced in relationship. If we each take a moment and think of a time and place we felt safest, if we imagine how it felt, where we were, who we were with, almost all of us will imagine being at home with our mothers, the sound of our grandmothers cooking in the other room, the sanctuary of a neighbor's house when our home wasn't safe, the companionship of our friends. Virtually none of us will actually think of police and prisons when we envision safety. And yet at the same time, when we think about how to produce public safety, those are the things we go to. The truth is, it is our relationships that keep us safest. And incarceration is made of isolation. It's made of separation. And for that very reason, it can never be productive of safety.
T in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, T.
Hello. You know, I'm very torn. I hear what you're saying, miss, and I want to be compassionate. I really do, because I know what poverty is. I know what it is to not have. I know what it is to have police run up on you as a young person and throw you up against the wall and pat you down and degrade you. But at the same time, at the age of 20, I know what it is to lose my best friend to violence. A 17-year-old girl thrown off a roof in the Bronx, okay? The guy continued to stay in the Bronx for years. He worked right there at the diner for years, okay? He went in and out of jail for assaults. He went in and out of jail for drugs. He went in and out of jail for all these little things. Meanwhile, he was a murderer and a rapist. So what do you, please tell me, what are we supposed to do with people like that? We're supposed to take them home and read them bedtime stories and say we're sorry that life was hard for you? What do you do, miss? Because I'm so angry. 30 years. They just found this guy last year. He walked the streets and did more crimes. So please tell me.
So first of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. And I think when we come to the question of murder, it becomes a much harder question because it's irreparable in a way that other harm, there's a pathway to repair. But the thing I would say is that it matters what you say about this man going in and out of jail and prison, because the truth is, if prison actually changed people for the better and if it made us safer, he would have come home better for it. He would have stopped causing harm. He would have not hurt anyone else the way he hurt the person whom you loved. And what I believe is that we deserve a response to violence that is going to reduce violence in the future. We deserved that before he hurt the person you love. We deserved for whatever he did before that to have been met with an answer that would have prevented him from going on and doing what he did. That said, when we hurt somebody, we incur an obligation, period, no matter what. And so it's not about holding him close or cuddling him up or reading him a story. It's about offering the people who lost that loved one the opportunity to shape what he has to do, if at all possible, to begin to make things right. And that may or may not be imaginable for a loss that severe, but I believe that option deserves to be on the table for survivors, that survivors should have a pathway not just to retribution, but also to repair, on the chance that it actually means that other people won't experience that kind of loss.
But play it out. What if they had found this guy right away, 30 years ago, when T's best friend was murdered, and T was, you know, a meaningful survivor as if family? What would his options have been?
So at Common Justice, we don't work with murder cases. We do work with attempted murder, and the decisions about whether or not it goes into a restorative justice process really rest with
Murder's
the survivor.
Murder's in another category than what you're really writing about and advocating.
It is, for the most part, and yet at the same time, I know people who have lost people to murder who hoped that the incarceration of the person who killed their loved one would resolve their pain and found that it didn't. Like, they were promised a certain relief when that person was finally apprehended and finally locked up. And the day after and the year after and 15 years after, they find that that grief is unrelenting. And so I don't pretend that we have in place as a culture yet the kind kind of robust infrastructure that would be required to completely displace incarceration. At the same time, I think we have to stop pretending that incarceration is adequate and that it actually heals anyone at all.
T, anything else you want to say?
I would like to say that I agree with you on many levels. I disagree, if at all, with your thought that just allowing, the victims or the family of the victims, maybe us having some say would make us feel better. I don't know, because they offered this guy a plea deal, and he's guilty, and so what? Maybe he'll do 10 years, but he was free. He'll have had been free longer than he'll be in jail for what he did. So it's very hard for me to imagine justice in this system. So I agree with you on that level. It does have to change.
I
thank you for taking it.
And I thank you very much for making it.
And I would just say, too, that you're exactly right, that there's not a number of years incarceration that's somehow the equivalent to the pain of that kind of loss, right?
There's a burden that I think he was getting at in the system you're describing on survivors of violent crime to not just be there in court, maybe if they go to court as the victim, but to have a responsibility, which maybe is liberating, but also maybe is a burden, to have some say in how the perpetrator of the crime gets treated by the system. You know, they say that a crime is a crime against the state, not against the individual, because they don't want to encourage sort of vigilante justice by individuals and community members. But what about this as a burden?
So we believe survivors deserve the option, not that survivors have the obligation to participate in these processes. In our processes, some survivors choose to be represented by a surrogate, by someone who's been through something similar, who can speak to the seriousness of that kind of experience, represent their interests, and stand in their place in a process that they may or may not want to walk through on their own. We don't owe anything for being hurt. We are owed something for it. And at the same time, the survivor doesn't make that decision alone. The prosecutor has to consent. Mm-hmm. We screen the person who committed the crime and exercise our own judgment about whether they can complete the rigors of the program. So the burden is shared, but the opportunity should be theirs.
And that's a good way to end in our last 40 seconds or so. You're not just describing an abstract notion of reform. You're talking about a program that you actually run in Brooklyn, where this kind of restorative justice is an option under certain circumstances. Just give people the, I know we started with it, but end with it too. Give people the nutshell of what that is, and you know, God forbid they're on either side of this in the future, how they could participate.
We're in both Brooklyn and the Bronx now, and in cases like stabbings and gunpoint robberies, cases of serious violence, if and only if the survivors and the prosecutor both consent, we bring that case into a restorative justice process in which we acknowledge the harm of done to the people hurt and convene a dialogue where they reach agreements about what the responsible person can do to make things as right as possible. At the same time, we support the survivors in coming through what happened to them and in their lives generally for as long as they want our help.
Danielle Sered, that's S-E-R-E-D, from Common Justice, and her new book is Until We Reckon, Violence, Mass Incarceration, and the Road to Repair. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.